Good evening, everyone. This is Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, and we're studying together the hidden work by E.J. Gold. This is our fourth or fifth book that we've worked with thus far, and it's an exciting book. It's one of the fundamental books, I think, in the pantheon of his offering on spiritual work. And it's important to understand the context. And everybody, I'm kindly putting this in for the for others that might listen later. But this is part of a bit of a, what I call the triad. The triad being the human biological machine and life in the labyrinth. And then, in many ways, the hidden work is that next part. And in the hidden work, we're talking about really life in the essential self, life in the in so-called the hidden world, but in many ways that world has more certitude for us. There's more certainty about it. As much as we like to think that the world about us is so real, it's predictable in many ways. In certain ways it isn't, but there's a certain sense of certainty when you get into these other worlds. We're working our way through chapter 3, and last week we did the first part of it where there was a lot of distinction between the concept of prayer as supplication and something called objective prayer. And in objective prayer, EJ, the author, says to us at some point that we make prayer. We don't pray for something. And that's a important distinction. But why don't we reorient just a little bit? And Ivan, do you want to read the header for us?
It is chapter 3.
For chapter 3, and let us know where we're at.
Ogdonis, the oldest form of prayer is not supplication. It is a means of helping the absolute, and the means by which we can absolve ourselves of original sin. We should think of prayer absolute as fulfilling our obligation as human beings.
So we talked about that a little bit last week, and where we ended last week was at the very bottom of page 19, the very last paragraph. And in that last paragraph, we start out with a phrase, in addition, we can only awaken the machine in its lifetime by voluntarily ascending the cross. And it goes on, of course, at the moment of death, the machine will not be asked to volunteer. So at some point, that event has to occur. And that's such an important concept, so important to what we're the work here. Let's spend a little time and see if we can unpack what is meant by this idea of ascension onto the cross, voluntary ascension onto the cross. And this is closely tied to the idea of obligation. I'm going to read something that Harry wrote on the website, wingsofchaos.com, and you'll see this comment under chapter 3, and want to thank you, Piangio, for putting it in. For part 2 of chapter 3, we address the idea of obligation. When essence is contacted, the sense of obligation to the absolute is born and begins to grow. This first contact is a gift, a seed entrusted to us. But its care and nurturance depend upon our own efforts that we freely accept the obligation to serve. This obligation is always free, a free choice on our part, cannot be coerced even by the absolute. Our only freedom to disobey confers value on our obedience. Only our freedom to disobey confers value on our obedience, and it is only this freedom to serve or not that distinguishes humans from other forms of life. We do not work as slaves, but as real human beings. We eventually learn that obedience to this obligation is the price we pay for awakening, and that there is no way back. This is the space where negativity is eaten by higher beings and where the substances are generated that will form the vessels of our future service. So does that give us a hint? Do we begin, what then can mean this, and I read that quote from Harry specifically. What then could it mean we ascend to the cross? What is that cross? And we saw earlier in the chapter that the imagery of Jesus on the cross wasn't that Jesus died for our sins, but actually it's indicated that it's a symbol of something that we're able to do, that the Absolute is on this cross. And the Absolute is on a cross, and that cross and that what is being born is the sleeping mass of existence, in a sense. Existence is deadened. It's sitting there, operating in a mechanical manner. As said to me earlier today, it's like the human is a zombie. The human is a zombie. And then what does it take then to awaken that? And once it begins to awaken, we see this a few paragraphs before, it says that part of our job is to consciously use our life in our time for the perfection of the inner qualities, attention, presence, and consciousness. So, once again, what is the sense for you that it means ascension onto the cross? Anybody?
There's a few comments.
Okay, go ahead, Susan.
Becky Sunnybrook says, like in the dream Jacob had when he was sleeping with his head on the rock, Jacob's ladder.
Okay.
Molly says the crux of the situation. Piandra says the cross is the creation, Jacob's ladder.
The cross is the creation. But what does this mean for us to ascend to the cross? Where is the Absolute in this imagery that we're talking about? Where does the Absolute stand? Where is the Absolute? How, in which way, is that Absolute nailed to the cross?
Jim H. said, exchanging places with Absolute, becoming the Absolute.
What does that mean, though? Here we are in a practical manner. What does it mean? What sense of consciousness can we accept?
You know, David, what occurs to me, the way I apply it in my own case is I presume that the whole of my human biological machine is the cross within which the essential self has become identified. So as we awaken our essential self, it's actually our essential self, which is aware of the fact that the creation is asleep, and the essential self can't escape this sleeping creation, and we're striving simply to create conditions that allow the essential self to become the predominant electrical field as opposed to the machine itself.
Okay, so did we understand what Silverdale was telling us? Ivan? Put it into words.
Well, I didn't hear all of it all that well because of the phone here, but Yeah, I think that our machine, the sleep of our machine, corresponds to this involuntary creation. You know, this is like a metaphor, it's a correspondence, microcosm and macrocosm.
As above, so below.
Yeah. Process or effort to awaken the machine is somewhat of a reflection of this crucifixion. But I think to ascend to the cross means to give up separation, actually, to take the perspective of being outside the creation, being outside of what's involuntary, and being the actual cause of it or source of it, which is to say the creator of it. And I think that's where the excruciating part of that experience comes in, that it's the being nailed to this involuntariness of the creation. That's what I get out of when he writes about this.
This narrow slice of this commentary of what does it mean to ascend to the cross, I think Silverdale helps us out immensely, as often he does. When the essential self starts to awaken, one of the things that it perceives, first of all, begins to perceive that its own, this human biological machine, this my envelope, is in fact asleep. And we get these hints as we go through our lives. Right, Susan? That
oh, yeah.
It's asleep and it works mechanically. It just works. And then suddenly, there it is. And the mechanicality of it just slaps us. And we go, oh, my gosh. And then the first response, of course, is, oh, gosh, that's bad. That's a sin. And then, of course, you stop thinking about it, which is one of the ultimate ploys of the ego, is I won't notice it anymore. And you stay away from issues where it comes up, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first thing. You start to notice that when the essential self starts to flourish, you say, gosh, here's a different form of life altogether. But then as it starts to emerge even a little bit further, and this is maybe the second portion of this, George, is it starts to... It looks around and it goes, oh my God, or oh my gosh, all of creation is asleep. There you have the same, in a certain way, the same burden that I would imagine is the viewpoint that the absolute is stuck on. It said, okay, as Brahma said, you know, issue forth creation, and it issues forth, and you're stuck with it in a certain way, and yet at the same time, it's asleep. So can we, as we grow the essential self and it starts to flourish more, can you stand in that position for 1 second? Very, very hard when you accidentally get there. If you even start to get a glimpse of it, the glimpse puts you in a place, first of all, you're compelled to help. Everything that might smack of awakening of that, the sense around us, helps alleviate the dread of this sleepiness of creation.
And you know, Dave, what I find the terror of the situation is as you've rightly observed, when we see it just in ourself alone, how asleep and mechanical we are, and then by extension, we extend it to the planet, the planetary asleepness and mechanicalness. Listen, it's a challenge for any one of us to do it for ourselves alone, but boy, what about an entire sleeping planet, much less perhaps extending into the rest of our solar system? I mean, it's an impossible task, it seems.
So we're faced with that, the very edges of that sensitivity, Silverdale. We kind of like brush against it. And when we touch it, we want to run away. So we look around us and we see somebody acting in a way we don't like. And we immediately say, that jerk, that person was trying to say something to me. And they didn't respect my ego. They're really a jerk. But we don't want to say, we don't want to accept the fact that person is acting in a mechanicality that is shocking to us. And it's that mechanicality that once you start to sense it, and I guarantee you, you run away from it, as I have. Every time I get close to it, I flee, because it just hurts too much, quite frankly. Susan, I've babbled on too much. Are there comments?
Yes, let me go back.
Thank you.
So Mark was saying that stepping into the absolute being position, sharing it a bit, assuming some of the mantle of the infinite aloneness.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're sitting there in a realm of sleeplessness and you see a little spark, we can't really attribute human characteristics to the absolute. I want to be careful of that. On the other hand, it is a way of us actually seeing. So.
Jim comments, accept essential self is the absolute. Is one, there is no other.
Nice. Very good.
Pianjo said, since we are made in the image of God, awakening our machine by resonance awakens the creation. As our essence grows, we feed the absolute.
Yes. So all of this to say that if that's really what these fine individuals are indicating here, they're saying, gosh, you awaken the machine, and as you awaken the machine, something starts to happen with the essential self. It starts to grow. It starts to come alive a little bit and even begins to flourish. And then it sees this. Right? To begin to see this. Now, let's proceed on with this very difficult chapter. This is not an easy chapter, people. My gosh. So, voluntary, we're going to come back to that phrase. Real functioning centrums, even lower centrums, have an objective function in the performance of prayer absolute. But no single centrum can have the will to awaken the machine or to take voluntary assumption upon the cross. And so it is said that no single centrum acting alone can achieve contemplation of man on the cross sufficiently to perform effective prayer absolute. Big words, lots of stuff there. So first of all, what are the centrums? What are the centrums he's talking about? No single centrum? Are there more than one? What are they? Anybody?
Thinking, feeling, and moving.
So.
And then there's a reflexive centrum.
The motor centrum activity of the prayer absolute must necessarily include all voluntary and involuntary actions during the day. A day of negativity produces the force for prayer. But all human beings function exclusively from the force of negativity anyway. However, during prayer absolute, our activities must be voluntarily produced from that which is not the source of negativity, which is to say that which is not the machine. So in this context, we understand that negativity in part means just reactive behavior, right? And it's not, a bad emotion, and happy emotions are good. No, it's reactive, any reactive. We have, you know, someone says, gosh, I really like your clothes and your beam. That's a reactive,
negative emotion.
Yeah. So it's, so we come from not that place, but we go through the day and that's what surrounds us in a sense. And we accumulate this energy, and as Pian just says to us in his writing, this is the space where our negativity is eaten by higher beings. We don't know what that means yet, but we'll investigate it. So there's this, what is meant by negativity? Any other thoughts on that? Susan, anything there?
Well, Becky was asking, would creative activity not be of the machine?
True creativity is born out of the essential self. In the essential self, there is creativity. It is, there's no linearity to it. It is a fountain of creativity. So it's not that creativity equals the essential self. It's the essential self is creativity. So you begin first with a sense of presence, attention, and your own consciousness in there. And when you sense that, you're creative. Okay?
She does say passive activity, ? Is negative.
Yeah.
Which activity?
Passive.
Passive.
Bring your mic closer.
Yeah.
Aura adds, Becky, I think creative energy helps to move you out of the automatic thinking and reactivity if you can open yourself to the flow and the essential self. You get out of your own way.
Okay. So the machine is the source of all negativity. We will use this negativity, which has accumulated during the course of day, to feed our prayer absolute. So it's there, it's happening, it's occurring. We're pummeled by it during the day. And it's in us, and it creates a form of energy. There's just energy. It's not good energy, bad, it's just energy. And that energy, if converted, we can use to help fuel the quality of our prayer, of the prayer absolute. Okay? We must not allow the machine to remain negative during prayer. This is a simple problem because during prayer absolute, the machine must be awakened. And when it is awake, it cannot produce negativity because the invocation of presence eats the negative force. You go through the day, that is what's going to happen. So sit there in the sense, reflect on yourself, begin to get a sense of yourself, remember yourself, and that you will reflect on those items and process that. Just allow it to be, and in presence, you're not it. I am not that. Okay? Is there other comments? Let's get some more comments going.
Can you hear me?
No, go ahead.
Okay. There's a comment from Mark Roach that says, in a lot of the orbs, it says stuff like clarity comes from you, not to you. To me, that's one of the keys of not negativity.
Okay.
And then there's just...
Go ahead and read them.
Okay. Mark says, love that the invocation of presence eats the negative force.
Okay.
And that's about all for now.
That's it?
Yes.
She read that. Yeah. So when... Clarity in... So invocation of presence and the practice of attention, when we have the practice of our essential attention, which we understand to mean, you mean it as well as we can, and we sit there with our attention, that's where we come from first, rather than reacting to the outside world. When we sit there in that sensitivity, there is the invocation of presence. When you are in the invocation of presence, you have the ability to source. You are clarity. You don't start with clarity, and that creates presence. It's we work to stay in that sense of presence to the extent we are able. Fortunately, we have the machine to produce negative force, so we could not perform prayer absolute. How unusual. With what could we feed our self-invocation? Without negative force serving as food, how can we awaken the machine by voluntary assumption of the cross? Wild, huh? Every real school has some form of obligatory prayer absolute, which must be repeated both in the early morning and early evening, at about sunset and sunrise and sunset, or the effect of prayer absolute is not obtained. Is Simon on? Yeah, he used to talk about some of these disciplines as well. And of course, I didn't bring the Book of Hours. I was going to bring it. And there's six times during the day that in the Catholic tradition, they break whatever they're doing and pray, as we see in the Muslims as well, five times a day.
And facing Mecca.
So it's like you stop, and it's like it interrupts the day, interrupts the mechanicality of the day. In a sense, we partake of the body of the Absolute, who had nothing but himself with which to make the world. Out of him, that world was made. Thoughts, comments, questions?
Questions.
Go ahead.
Simon is asking, what does it mean, communion, in this context?
What does it mean from what?
Communion.
Where does it say that? Oh, yeah. Perhaps in a school, we should also take communion each time we eat or drink. Okay, and I didn't read that sentence.
Well,
Go ahead.
EJ talks about this actually in a number of places, I think in a number of ways, but in one of the ways he talks about it is that you're, let's say, to feed the essence, to feed the awakening process, instead of sitting down at the table to a meal, and let's say mechanically eating food that's just going to have a biological function, we need to think of the food as alive, as still alive as we eat it, and that we're taking it into ourselves as something alive, and that we're joining ourselves with it. We're transforming this food to a higher function, you know, but it comes in as a life form, as a living energy. And I think that this idea of communion is to say, what he's saying about it here is that it's the teaching or the, what do you call that, the tradition that you're taking this bread, you know, this bread is the body of the absolute. You know, it's the body of the entire, not just the creation, but of the creator. So that the communion means that you are taking a step toward that ascension, I think, to the cross. Let's say in this terminology here of pure absolute.
Once a week in the Catholic Church, we go to communion. And in communion, you receive the body and blood of Christ. You take a wafer and drink wine with the common body of your congregation. And you celebrate the Mass, and you celebrate that, and then take in the body and blood of Christ. And that will somehow do something for you, energize you in a certain way. We don't have that mythology, but what we work with is that you pull vegetables from your garden, and that lettuce is lying on your plate, and it's, in a sense, it's suddenly, of all that there is, it has found its way to you. It has found its way to you, and as you take it in, it's providing you with the work energy that you have to do your work. So you sit down to a meal, and do you wolf your food down because you're going to wolf it down because you're hungry? Or do you eat your food and participate in this ritual of energizing the machine such that it can carry on its work for one more day? So the plant, in that case, has the opportunity to sacrifice itself for the sake of your work.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So it's an energy. It's a living thing. It's an energy in this creation that it has the possibility of being part of the awakening of the...
of the absolute.
The awakening of the creation.
Of creation. So to the extent that we can sense that, Simon, I think that's what that moment can become. And when you do that, you start to become very aware of what you eat.
Let me see this line again. In fact, part of our work obligation is that whenever we eat or drink, we take communion. In a real sense, we partake of the body of the Absolute, who had nothing but himself with which to make the world.
The offer.
Out of him, the world was made. So this is, I think it's just striking me that this is a part of ascension, you know, to feel that everything that's coming into your machine, let's say, from this created universe, is all your, both yourself and what you're partaking of are part of what the Absolute was able to make creation out of, which was itself or himself. I had another thought about this, which is the tradition, you know, going to the Jewish tradition behind the Christian communion, happens to be this flatbread, you know, matzah, and the multiple glasses of wine that you drink at the Passover Seder, and, you know, the backstory, the background of that tradition is that the whole family, extended family, is sitting down at the dinner table together, and then you're having this ritual meal. You're partaking of this bread in a ritualized manner, and the reason is that it's why this night is different from all other nights, because you are remembering the history of your ancestors, remembering the history of the liberation from slavery that was brought about in Egypt, and that your people were freed and liberated and so on. In other words, it's a retelling. It's a legend. it's a story, a legend of release from bondage, which you're commemorating every year with the same ritual, and the bread and the wine that you're partaking of are part of that ritual. And one of the things that it does is that it joins you together with all the generations, both backwards and forwards, who are all liberated, and the idea of the benediction, let's say, the prayers that go with it and so on, and the invoking of the absolute, which you do at a Passover Seder, is to say that you're bringing about the liberation as a present event. Part of the thing that's said in the Passover Seder is that we are liberated, we're liberated along with the children of Moses and the children of Israel and so on, wandering in the desert. This is all happening to us. We're invoking this now in the present.
All the history is invoked at that time.
Yeah, it strikes me, I haven't thought about this much before, but that's a form of communion. I mean, that is, this is one of the feelings that you get when you sit down at the Passover Seder, let's say as a Jewish person, is that actually all over the world, with a slight fidget for time zones, what you might say, but that actually in celebrating that holiday, at family dinner tables, basically all over the world, people are sitting down and they're reenacting that, telling that story and reenacting that ritual, the same ritual and the same story.
The same night.
Yeah, the as a holiday, that same night. So that this is, so what's meant to be happening, in a sense, in the, what you call that, in the
community of,
yeah, in the biosphere, in the noosphere, let's say, in the sphere of awareness and consciousness, all of those people are joining hands together and invoking into the present their yearning, their sincere wish for liberation, actually, and that's. And I think that comes into play in the Christian communion also. It's both the joining together. The communion is the joining together of everybody who takes that wafer and the wine. But it's also, it's a invitation to move out of your small self, move out of the limited, the mechanical, let's say, the involuntary self. I think this is where we see it in more esoteric traditions, like what EJ is teaching here. It becomes, it's a liberation from being
asleep.
Fixed, from being stuck in sleep.
Being stuck in sleep.
Yeah.
Some people, when they're doing that kind of work and with their meal, and they realize that they're taking in this energy that flows through them, they dedicate that energy to their work. They dedicate it to the work of liberation.
For the benefit of all beings everywhere.
For themselves, but then at some point they are able to say, and for the benefit of all beings
everywhere.
So the Voyager is not complete until all are awakened. There's a lot of work to be done. We want to think of, we sometimes get in the thing that we think of our work is for ourselves so we can be liberated and we can be enlightened, and then we're cool and groovy. Well, that's okay, but the work before you is immense. And it's in implementing that and getting some of these systems out there and allowing one person to wake up, to be, when you go to the store and you're in the checkout and you're in a foul mood, can you exercise presence and attention right there and give it just a granular moment of essential self to that person? So that's just the long answer for Simon to what communion is.
Yeah, well, there's I think, isn't it in this book that we're going to get to a chapter called Feasting in the Real World? Anyway, I think that there's
thoughts of food.
Yeah, there's a chapter which treats of this subject, actually, about feasting in the real world. And I think I just noticed that, like what David's saying is, again, something I'm reminded of is that communion, like a real, the real communion, or let's say like the real Passover ritual that's happening when you sit down. It's extremely bright. It's very warm and fuzzy, and it's like everybody is congratulating everybody else, and you're. It's like it's an island of safety and idealism and so on. Because you spend this whole evening talking about freedom and liberation, and you might think of, and you recline, you know, just like in ancient times, it's like you imagine that, you know, instead of slavery, that you're like the slave master. So you recline, you relax, and drink this wine and so on, and have this relaxed meal and all that. But this is like, so it's sort of like saying, I think when EJ discusses this idea of feasting in the real world, it becomes like you have arrived. It's like you're, you know, if you have the ability to bring this creation awake, let's say you would be, find yourself in the real world. But then, you know, even in regard to the Passover Seder, like David's talking about, you go out, what about when you go out the next day and you're on the street, or you go back to work, or you're in the grocery store and so on? What's happened to that kind of next year in Jerusalem, like
and,
that whole warm
and
that fuzziness of all that?
That's our work. That's
yeah.
The fourth way work, because
yeah.
We are in the world but not of it.
Yeah.
But we have taken on not the monastic life, we've taken on the life of everyday prayer absolute, and that leads exactly into the next paragraph.
Yeah, good.
I do have some comments. At some
point. How about comments?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, my coach is saying that remembering history is a sort of communion.
Yeah.
Jim is saying through tradition we feel like one, and Mark says, through tradition, we open portals.
Correct. We open portals.
Right.
And so
no question about it.
Yeah, well, it may be that the awakening, maybe the awakening can go on to a genetic level, you know, like when you awaken the DNA of the whole species.
That's another conversation.
Yeah, right.
We've had that a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm going to move on real quick, Susan, it's so directly. We should think, therefore, of prayer absolute as fulfilling our obligation as human beings, not as some stupid mechanical religious function. Fulfilling our obligation as a human being, because we can do it. Because we are able to do it, so should we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this then begins the conversation of what is our obligation, and what is our obligation but a moment by moment, striving to be in that moment of clarity and prayer absolute. And then go on, when individuals group themselves together to form a circle devoted to the work, they are called a work circle. A work circle serves two purposes. It enables those who manifest some interest in the work to accumulate information about it. And at the same time, whether they wish it or not, it also inevitably introduces members to the method of prayer absolute. So we keep, probably for the sake of myth, we'll say, oh, in ancient times they did this. In ancient times, these are the good old days. This is what we are doing together tonight. This is the communion that is before us this evening, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
We are a work circle of individuals grouped together, devoted to the work. That's what we are here. We have individuals who work very hard, who have put themselves through a great deal. And the more they put themselves through, more comes up in them, and they're willing to face that. There are people right now, tonight, working on things in themselves that are very difficult. But because they have the sense of the essential self as their home, they're obligated to, in a sense, perform this prayer absolute together to clarify themselves so that they can fulfill their obligation as a human being and one inch of helping alleviate that suffering of the absolute and for the sake of all beings. So we are that work circle. We are that work circle coming together tonight. Right now, this is what's occurring. There are individuals right here in this room have worked very hard for many, 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 many years. People on the phone, people online right now, they're putting in many hours in this regard. So can we take that communion wafer that we develop during our morning prayer obligations and move forward into our day as an offering to those around us? And the answer is, yeah, we can. Jumping ahead a little bit. Yeah, but I'm jumping ahead to the next page, 22, top paragraph. We must eventually pay for our very existence. Even if it seems that life is free for the asking, we can pay little but bit now by voluntary What can you do? It's easy to get into the ego game, oh, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. But what can you do? What can you do? What little door is open for you? We can pay a little bit now by voluntary assumption. We can pay much more later on when the machine dies and we're forced to ascend. That's then. What is expected of those in the work is to develop a regimen, a certain time set aside to help the absolute. That's called an obligatory. This service is a good work habit, will carry us through and attach us, hopefully permanently to the work. Hopefully permanently to the work. We wish to ensure that the prayer absolute does not become mechanical. Once it becomes mechanical, of course, it is no longer prayer absolute. It is something other than that. The most basic purpose for ritual is purification and activation of the sanctuary. And there should be a place, like I talked to somebody yesterday, and she has a place, a little alcove, that is now her sanctuary. It's a sanctuary because she has imbued it with her prayer. She has, it's like she's painted the walls with it. The little space doesn't matter because she walks in there and there's, that's what you do when you're there. Okay? That's what you do. Creating sanctuary. And your sanctuary could be an object. Like I have, and I've shown this before, I have a coin. I have a coin in my pocket. Every time I pick that out, I know the meaning that this has for me. Every time I pick it up, no matter where I pick it up, it hits me in a certain manner, right? Always with me. Can you create a sense of sanctuary? For some of us, it'll be your altar area. We can share methods of this. And this, we got to work together to put some of these ideas online so others can share in it. And we are doing these wonderful collaborations. But also, like, how do you create sanctuary? What is your sanctuary? Maybe it's your car. You get into your car to drive to work. And is that a form of sanctuary for you? It is if you make it so. If it's just like wolfing down your food, you get in your car to rush to work because you're late, guess what? It's just a sleep activity then. Like no different than anything else. So activation of the sanctuary in which prayer absolute is performed. If the sanctuary is activated, per absolute can so be done. It is no more or less than the ritual in the kitchen, preparatory to cooking and serving food. And the subsequent ritual of clearing the table, washing. So if your function is, and I know a couple of you individuals, you prepare meals for others, at that moment, that's a moment of great prayer, because you're taking these depositories of energy that have sacrificed. They've said, okay, given themselves up such that they can play one moment in this activation of the work, and presenting that as a one slice and moment for the activation of prayer absolute, such that then we can service and help alleviate that suffering, that brief moment for the absolute. So think of that. Another function of sanctuary ritual is to ensure that no intrusions occur during the performance. So we talked about what do you do to prepare yourself when you come to this space here tonight. And several individuals have very specific things. Cleansing the space, they cleanse themselves. That is a moment of sanctuary. Mm-hmm. That's a sacred space. And so it will remain. So it will remain forever. Forever. If the heart has been repaired through the diligent practice of certain exercises, such as the popcorn exercise, the feeling centrum is able, powered by the additional force of adoration, to determine whether the sanctuary has been effectively cleansed. Prior to this, M.A. was reading from the popcorn exercise, and the popcorn exercise is in one of the talks of the month.
It's right here on this page.
Yeah. And right at the bottom, you can see where you can get it. Issue number 27.
A very good talk that EJ filmed on a DVD as to how to do the popcorn exercise.
And
nitty gritty.
It's so potent. Anybody who's got some attention going, you can introduce this to them in 10 seconds. I was at a conference, this flotation tank conference I was mentioning to you, Ivan.
Yeah.
And there was a guy there who is not in any particular spiritual practice, but I could tell that he was on the fringe of it. And we were sitting there at a dinner, and he and I got into that space,
mm-hmm.
and we were there together, and there was a 100 other people jabbering away. We were in a cone of silence. And I said, okay. All I said to him was, I said, okay, take your thumb, place your attention on your thumb, and move it back and forth. Keep your attention on that thumb as it moves back and forth. And it blew his mind. Why? Because it was for that moment his activated the essential attention, the attention of his essential self. For that moment, it was such an odd situation, too.
Right, at a dinner, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the force of adoration. Susan, Aria, I don't think Hawk Lady's on tonight. But I was wondering if Susan or Aria wanted to say anything about the force of adoration.
Okay, that leaves me.
Yeah.
I can see how the power of adoration, especially in using it towards other people, can bring them to life.
Okay.
Not sure what you're wanting, but...
Have you experienced the force of adoration?
Yes.
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 Simple and clear. Aria? Anybody else who would like to comment on the force of adoration? A huge topic in some of the other books, but I want to bring it back up tonight.
So Aria says, for me, the force of adoration changes me and strikes me so deeply it's piercing. Changes me internally, she added.
Changes her internally. Changes in.
And then Mark Roach said, for me, it brings something to life.
Adoration is a different concept than, oh, I like that. Oh, I really, really like that red car. It's really cool. You know?
Well, I think of it as fire. You know, it's like a chemical fire. So
adoration is the, in a certain way, it's the expression of our love for something. It's our expression of our love, period. It's not for something necessarily. And that's a practice that we can perform here together in this environment called the work circle. When we come together, we can practice that, because we have to practice it. We're not, it's not a common thing that we do in the world. These are things, the popcorn exercise, this idea of the force of adoration, these are different tools that we have, and we have them available to ourselves. So practice it.
Can I add these last few comments?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
Can you speak try to speak a little bit louder, because we're having trouble on this end.
Okay.
With our phone.
Okay, so Jim said, hits me as a wave emotion one day when the sun came out from behind the cloud. Molly said, the force of adoration brings on transformational effects.
Yes.
Mark said, even what could have been a dry spiritual practice becomes something magical and fun and sacred. Becky says,
yeah.
When in adoration, I die. The beauty of what is alive, and I dissolve.
The machine dies at that point, and the angelic self comes forth. Like when Jim had this experience with this, when he was seeing nature in a certain way, it appears to be an emotion, but it's actually an outpouring from, you'll feel it from the heart center, and it goes out. As we practice this more and allow this more in our lives, and we wind up with more capacity to allow that grace to come through us, and that is part of what can power our ability to function in prayer absolute. Okay? So this also, this last phrase, to determine whether the sanctuary has been effectively cleansed. You will know that as you work more with those two principles of the popcorn exercise and the force of adoration. You'll say, oh, this is the right space. Or you'll sniff and you'll say, oop, something's off a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
Got to get a broom out, an inner broom. The more we work on the purification and activation of our sanctuary, the more we work on the purification and the activation of our sanctuary, the closer we get to the prototype. Time is the highest key. When there is no delay between the time something happens and the time we perceive it, then we will be on the cross. Only then will we understand why we were created. Big meal in this chapter. but it allows us to start exercising these wonderful muscles that we were given, these wonderful tools. There's just, it's like, goodness gracious, what an opportunity. And then give back is what it's saying. It's just saying, how can you pay for our very existence, or this idea, fulfilling our obligation. We're given this treat of existence. What else you got there, Susan?
There's quite a few great comments.
Go for it.
Let me go back. I apologize. Okay, so Aria said, it is lifting and mind-blowing, like the heart bursting into flames. Reminds me of the ecstasy of St. Teresa of Avila. Mark said, and since it is our love, if we can find a suitable object for adoration.
Yes.
Mark said, then there's a very feeling, because we can put our full totality, congruent energy and feeling into it.
Yes. Good.
Piandra says, adoration is like a translucent cloud of love, a field of energy that consumes me. It is a warm energy.
And it is a warm energy, and it's a burning energy. It's almost like a flame that is not necessarily comfortable when it burns in its own certain manner. Back to a little bit what Mark said about these objects, and that, of course, is the foundation of the iconographic imagery and objects throughout history, you know, that we have an icon upon which we can focus this adoration, and it fulfills our ability. Part of it is it's allowing ourselves to adore, allowing ourselves to love, allowing that to occur, not to think about it, not the thought of it, right? The actual experience of it, very different. Go ahead, Susan. Sorry.
Mark says, without any reservation compared to regular life, when there is often a plus and a minus to all decisions. So adoration is one of those events in life where it is the easiest to put all ourselves fully into.
Nice. Nice. Really well put. Mark, if you can put those comments, put them together and put it on the website of wingsofchaos.com. Hidden Work Chapter 3, that would be very, very helpful if you're up to that. Just copy your log. Those are really, really good. Very nice. Thank you, Susan. Next.
Molly says, adoration awakens grace, which is that which makes it all worth it.
Grace.
I think we've done it.
I was reading some stuff on the ancient Greek gods earlier today, and the idea of ambrosia and nectar.
Oh yeah.
And the do you remember the blood that flowed through the gods?
No.
Harry, do you remember what that is? Called Ichor, I think it's
Ichor, yeah.
Ichor is how it's pronounced, and it's a substance that gives life and immortality, and that particular comment about grace is that when we are allowed, we open up our hearts. That's something we can do. We are then paid back, and grace descends. But it's our ability to open up the heart and to absorb more. And certain individuals I know have gone through a great deal, and when they're doing this, their heart is opening up more. And they come back on the other end of it, and at that point, more is allowed in. And guess what? And then there's this sense, and they can give back to the fulfilling of this obligation. Goes hands in hand in hand. So is that about it, Susan? Are we done?
Yes.
I've gone over time, and I appreciate everybody's work this evening, and I want to point to Harry and Arcee and the work that they did with summarizing this wonderful chapter. This is a great chapter. Read it again. But next week we're going to move on to Chapter 4, Bound and Returned, and I'll be putting that up in the next day or two, the summary that that Jim and Simon did. I believe that's going to be a two-week chapter, so the Chapter 5 folks should adjust accordingly, and I think I'll be assigning Chapter 6 tomorrow. So thanks for coming. Look forward to seeing you next week. Good night.
Thanks, all.
Thanks, David and Ivan.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.